Hi, my name is Howard Ebert, and I'm 65 years old. Today is November 21st, 2017, and I am speaking with Tony Pickler, who is a friend and colleague. We'll be talking a little bit more about that as this unfolds. We are recording this interview in De Pere, Wisconsin. Well, Tony, our history goes back quite a while, and I think it might be interesting just to talk about how we first met.
Sure. So I was youth ministry coordinator at St. Bernard's in Appleton, St. Bernard Parish, and we had a, I would say, newborn or toddler, maybe, Andy. I think he was probably one or two at the time. And you had a newborn toddler, Allison, mm-hmm. who was probably, I think, 1 year older than Andy, maybe, or a half year or something mm-hmm. like that. And I remember, so on Sundays, we would attend Mass at St. Bernard's together, and you'd bring your family, I'd bring mine, and we would sit in this, what was called a lounge. And mm-hmm. the lounge was kind of a closed circuit TV set up where you were not in the church proper, but you were just removed from that, but you could see the Mass on TV. Mm-hmm. And so your family, my family, and others would sit in that space and watch the Mass and mm-hmm. participate in that way. And it was just so interesting because you were a theology professor, or at least becoming one, and mm-hmm. I think you were finishing your PhD, as I remember.
Yeah, I was just finishing. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I was working in a church, and I was starting a master's degree here at the college. And there were our kids mm-hmm. Playing and eating Cheerios and, you know, throwing up on the floor and doing whatever they did.
Yes, and they did all those
things. They did them all.
And it was a carpeted room.
Right, yes. So it was just a time when, I guess, two people then who dedicated their entire lives to the church met in very ordinary circumstances with kids and Cheerios and mm-hmm. little books.
And I'm trying to remember, how do we find out about each other? That I don't remember.
I think I knew that you were here, or okay. you were coming here, or I think you were teaching here at the college, and it just started, I thought.
Yeah.
And because I was starting the master's degree, I hadn't had you yet for class, mm-hmm. but I knew that you were on faculty, and okay. yet that didn't really play any part on Sundays because
you're supposed to say you were very impressed.
Yeah, but you are not the professor from St. Norbert's, and I, quite frankly, wasn't even the youth ministry mm-hmm. coordinator at St. Bernard's at that time. We were two dads who
right.
were sitting on mm-hmm. Lounge chairs trying to make sure that the Cheerios were picked up
yeah, right.
when we left the space.
That's right. So then we fast forward here because mm-hmm. that would have been, I started here at St. Norbert College in a tenure track position. I was mm-hmm. here for a part-time position mm-hmm. and all that. But in 1989,
okay.
And then you came, did you get a job at the diocese?
In 1993. So
okay.
It was probably as you were in that, maybe the transitional years
yeah.
of not being on the tenure track position. I'm not sure.
But, yes.
Because I'm not sure what year you moved up to De Pere.
1992. Because 92. We didn't move
okay.
until I got tenure.
Okay.
Because Patty, my wife, mm-hmm. said, why move if you don't get tenure, mm-hmm. which was a good question.
Smart. She's a smart one in the family.
Yeah, because we yes. actually bought a lot in De Pere in mm-hmm. 1990, but we decided mm-hmm. we would not build mm-hmm. until
92.
I got tenure, okay. and I got tenure in 1990.
And I came up 1 year later, Janine okay. and I and our kids. Well, Megan hadn't been born yet, but mm-hmm. Andy and I and Janine came up in 93. And that's when I took the position at the diocese as youth ministry consultant.
Okay.
Working in the education department.
And that position you held for how long?
About 11 years, a little over 10 years.
Okay.
A little over 10 years. And then in 2003, accepted the position as lay ministry formation director.
Mm-hmm.
And so slid over to that and did that for 12 years. So
okay.
I was at the diocese for about 22 years.
Yeah. And at our time together here, would have began, I never had you for class. I think you
I did not have you for class, although, no, I did have you. I had you for did colloquium. You?
Oh, how could I forget?
I had you for, I was one of your star students in colloquium. but no, that was the one time I did have you.
Okay.
And then I think it was in 1999 or 2000 where I worked part-time in lay ministry formation and part-time for the youth ministry area.
Right.
Splitting a position, and then did that for 2 years, and then went back to full-time youth ministry. But it was in those 2 years that I became active on the advisory committee here for the master's program.
And that you've been active with since then.
Since 1999 or 2000. So
yeah, because I became director of the Master's Theological Studies in 1998 when Dick Verbust retired, and have served in that position since.
Right.
Which brings me to the question about ministry and lay ecclesial ministry and the changes you've seen in that area since, let's go back to early 1990s. What have you seen? And then I maybe share with you a little some of my thoughts about.
Well, a few things. One, I would say there's been certainly an explosion. There was an explosion in lay ecclesial ministry back in the 80s and the 90s, and I would say in the first decade of the 2000s. So much so that it grew to, I think the latest numbers were about 40,000 lay ecclesial ministers in the country.
Wow.
So when I was lay ministry formation director, it had just broken the 30,000 mark. So anyway, the explosion has just been incredible in terms of the number of people working in fields that, you know, in the 60s or 70s you didn't even dream about. So that definitely has been a change. I think the growth of the diaconate has been a big change and shift in our church. I think the resources to pay lay ecclesial ministers has greatly diminished. And so one of the biggest changes I've seen is the shrinking of parish staffs. And when I was at St. Bernard's in Appleton, we had on our faith formation, our what we called School of Religion staff, I think it was 7 people, including administrative assistants. So it was a big staff, a person for every grade level. It was incredible. Now a parish like that, you're probably looking at 2. You know, so the number of people on parish staffs has changed dramatically. What I'll say is the education level has changed. I mean, there's I would say fewer people. You know, trying to achieve a master's level, for instance, parishes kind of tightening the belt and cutting corners a little bit, I think, rely on either volunteers or people that have gone through formation programs. So education level at a little bit lesser degree than there were maybe 20 or 30 years ago.
I have to say, from my angle as director of the MTS, yes, one of the things we've seen recently is increase in the number of deacons. Of course, part of that reflects that the diocese now is accepting or approving deacon candidates, diaconate candidates to be in our graduate program. But the numbers have leveled off a bit and actually declined, which is alarming because the demands, I think, for people in ministry are all the greater, not only in terms of time, but also intellectually greater as people become more educated. The internet, a lot of ideas flying around out there from a lot of different areas. And you really need leaders who are well educated. Right. So there's an area of concern there for me that for whatever reason, and again, I think part of it is salary, that people just simply cannot raise a family on the salary that a lot of parishes. Part of it is a change, I think, in the ethos in the church. I think in when I think back to Vatican II, right after Vatican II, 70s, into the 80s, and why the diocese even started this program in the graduate program was because there was a recognition and an appreciation for well-educated individuals in leadership roles. Today it seems as though, I don't know if education is as valued. I know that's maybe a little controversial, but it seems as though, well, we can get by with less. And I'm nervous about that. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that I think we as a graduate program need to do is be stronger advocates mm-hmm. of the necessity of people being well educated in the faith, mm-hmm. the richness of the tradition, the breadth of the tradition. I mean, it's very mm-hmm. impressive. Not mm-hmm. that we haven't had our dark moments, sadly we've had, but there's a lot of wealth there that is untapped mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. And do you have any suggestions for how we might be able to, because your position has changed now too, we should say that.
Right, so now I'm at the Abbey, St. Norbert mm-hmm. Abbey, in the Norbertine Center for Spirituality, and it's so I'm the director of the center. So so parish positions have become much more complex because mm-hmm. of the shrinking in the numbers. The complexity has increased, and so mm-hmm. when I was a youth ministry coordinator, the other half of my job was junior high religious education coordinator. I love junior high.
Well, I taught junior high for 3 years.
Now middle school, but back then junior high. Yeah. So the complexity has changed because back then, you know, this is in the late 80s, mid 80s, late 80s, early 90s. I was focused on junior high and some high school, but junior high, that was my thing. Mm. Those 7th, 8th, 9th graders, that's what I did. Well, today you could never get away with that because you wouldn't have just junior high. You're gonna have high school. You're gonna have young adults. Mm-hmm. You're gonna have younger children. You're gonna have womb to tomb. The complexity of knowing all that. You might be thrown pastoral ministry. You might be thrown liturgy. Mm-hmm. You might be thrown some of the parish business aspects. Mm-hmm. So there's so much more complexity, and I would think complexity equals a greater demand on education and formation. And, when I was at the diocese, we did see more and more people coming back to be formed in more than one area because the growing, the observation that there was a need for greater formation, for instance, in pastoral ministry, if you were in the area of faith formation, because you're asked to do more.
Yeah.
So I think, it's a complex church out there, and I think a program at St. Norbert's in terms mm-hmm. of the master's program has shifted and changed as well. I mean, when I started in this program in 1987, I think it was, there were 5 tracks.
Yeah.
You know? And, and in fact, I went through a track that doesn't exist anymore, the Parish Business Administration track. Mm. And that's a kind of a... I would say a sign of the times mm-hmm. that you don't specialize in that area anymore. Mm-hmm. You don't specialize just in one area. You need to become kind of a jack of all trades, mm-hmm. so to speak, very well rounded. So a program like this has shifted, I think, to meet those demands, to be open to people taking classes in various areas, because mm-hmm. knowing that they're going to see that when mm-hmm. they hit a parish.
Well, and maybe we can shift the conversation here a little bit. I did want to ask you about youth ministry, but what got you interested in youth ministry, in being involved in the Catholic Church? Mm-hmm. Because it appears that youth today are not particularly interested. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just speaking now out of my perspective from the college. We have a few majors and minors, mm-hmm. but certainly most of our students mm-hmm. are not only not interested, but not even aware of possibilities mm-hmm. of working mm-hmm. in the church. So how did you get here?
That's a good question. I like many people in my era, I thought about a religious vocation. You know, maybe young people today, not as much thinking mm-hmm. about that, but back then, I would mm-hmm. say many people did. And so I thought about priesthood. And mm-hmm. one of the best pieces of advice I got from the vocation director in La Crosse at the time, Father John Parr, he said, when you go to college, don't go for a theology degree. Go for something else.
Hear that, by the way? You always want to go for a theology degree in college. Okay. I'm just trying to project
Said, don't go for a theology degree. Go for something else that you're interested in, because you're going to take plenty of theology. Mm. If you go through a seminary, you're going to have so much theology. take something else. Mm-hmm. So I actually went into college at the St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. As a psychology major. I really wanted to become a counselor, but had that mm-hmm. notion of maybe a priest counselor combination. So went in, I took three psychology classes, and on my third class was psych stats, and I completely bombed. And I asked the professor after the class was finished. I know, math is not me. So I asked the professor, do you need to be proficient in statistics if you want to be a counselor? And he says, well, yes, of course. You know, you need to be able to you know, hang with these statistics and know what they're talking about. And I said, well, if that's the case, I don't want anything to do with counseling. So I dropped out.
Okay.
And not of college, but of that major. And I needed to find something else. And so I thought, I'll become a religion teacher in a Catholic high school. I'd gone through Catholic education all my years. And I thought, I will become a religion teacher. Mm-hmm. And so I chose theology as my major, secondary education as a minor. And then through that process of college, I was really actually leaning towards becoming a Benedictine monk.
Wow.
And I was on that track until this one day, met my future wife, and then that totally
went by the bike.
She was at St. Ben's.
She was at St. Ben's.
So the sister school of St. John's, right?
Yeah, okay.
So, so anyway, I was then on that track of theology and secondary education, going to become a Catholic high school teacher. Doing some ministry on, you know, as a college student, as a catechist at one of the area parishes, a fourth grade catechist. And my senior year, I did an internship at that same parish running their first communion program. So little by little, taking on pieces of ministry. And then a fateful day happened when the DRE there, Director of Religious Education at the parish, said, you know, our youth ministry coordinator is leaving at the end of the year. Would you ever be interested? I had never, ever considered. I didn't even know youth ministry was a role. Uh-huh. We didn't have that in my church.
Yeah.
Didn't have that growing up. Didn't know it to be a role. Mm-hmm. And it was with that invitation that I considered it, looked around, looked at other positions, and then ultimately accepted that position. So in a sense, the rest is history, but it took just the asking, the question, the invitation. And I always tell people, I mean, that's how many, that's how people get into ministry many times, is just that invitation to consider it. And so then I went into parish ministry and diocesan ministry and now retreat ministry. And kind of 30 years later, here I am.
It's interesting how those critical moments for in my own life, I think back to, and I'm not quite sure why, but I wanted to be a priest from the get-go. Mm-hmm. I had a little play altar. I would play mass. My brother, who's 6 years older than me, is really good at making things. I mean, he made an altar for me. I had an altar stone, a boulder underneath.
I wonder what your homilies were like back then. Were they as long as your lectures in class?
I hope we can cut some of this interview. And I just wanted to be a priest. That's it. And I'm the only person in my family that went to college. In fact, in my relation, there's only one other person that went to college. So I went to the minor seminary, the high school seminary. I was the youngest in our family. I don't, thank God, in one way, my parents didn't tell me how hard it was for them to see me go. They've been always very supportive of me, whatever. And, but it actually occurred, I mean, when my dad was dying, he told me, you know, it was really hard for us to see you go off, but we wanted you to do what you wanted to do. So I went to minor seminary, went to college, not because, but I had to go to college to be a priest, and came here. At the time, it was at Sacred Heart Seminary, and we got bused into St. Norbert College. And it was in a philosophy class, freshman year, first semester, freshman year. Bob Vandenberg was my philosophy teacher. And I just fell in love with philosophy. And Bob saw something in me. I mean, I got, because at the time there were seniors in the class and the freshmen, we all sat in the front row because we were so intimidated by people in the back. And I remember I never answered anything, but he had seen my written work. And to this day, I remember one day he said, well, Howard Ebert, you look like you have something to say. What did you think? And I babbled something, but that opened the door. Mm-hmm. And then he, as we got to know each other, and he was always really supportive of me, you know, going on the priesthood. But he said, boy, if you ever think about another career, I think you could be a good teacher. Mm-hmm. And that opened the door to teaching that I, because I never could imagine myself doing anything else but being a priest.
Yeah.
And so often those general invitations are kind of no invitations, but it's made all the difference, the difference in the world. Mm. So now your work at the Norbertine Center, now I got to get this right, Norbertine Center for Spirituality.
For Spirituality, right.
Yeah, this is a very different role.
Right.
What are some of the joys and maybe frustrations of that role? Yeah.
Well, one of the joys is that, the Abbey is such a peaceful place. I mean, it's a wonderful environment to work in. We get to create some really great experiences for people to explore their faith. So we have so many different programs, so many different retreats going on over there that, it's there's such a freedom in that. And I love that part. I love having people come to the center, to the Abbey, and just, they're there, they're hungry, they want to experience the holy, experience God, and as a minister there, you get to be a part of that. And it's incredible. I mean, it truly is incredible. I think, one of the challenges, we touched on it, you touched on it a little bit when you talked about young people. Today's culture doesn't really help that. It doesn't help kind of the secularization or let's just face it, look at the church attendance today and the major drops. And I've been to churches lately where I look around and I think, wow, this place used to be full and it's not full anymore. And parking used to be a problem. It's not a problem anymore.
Anymore.
It was good for us, but not good for the church.
Yep.
So that also has a bleed over to a place like a spirituality center. And it's just pure numbers, in terms of a drop, I think, in the people that are engaging in that. And so we see that at the center as well. Groups that used to bring in, even 4, 5, 6 years ago, bring in, 35, 40, 45 people, might bring 25 people, just that tangible drop in numbers. We see it at the center just as much as a parish would see it. So that's a challenge.
Is it demographically? You guys do so much programming across, across a wide range of opportunities, but older people typically?
Yeah, by and large.
Which, by the way, I like older people.
Good, because you're getting to be older, Howard. demographically, certainly older, certainly more female than male. Certainly the Green Bay to Pier area more than outlying areas. If you wanted to say who is the person, similar to the Rebuilt book, when Timonium, Maryland, was it? When they said, who is our parishioner? They kind of put a caricature on that. And it became Timonium Tim or something like that. Well, who is the person that comes to the Abbey? It's probably more or less a woman who is maybe 65 to 70 years old. Probably, upper middle class, Caucasian, so not that that's everybody, but it's majority. And so always the challenge then is to break out beyond that. So, in terms of age, in terms of socioeconomic, in terms of color of skin, beliefs, creed, etc. One of the ways that we've tried, now this will be our fifth year coming up in January and February to do this, one of the things that we've developed is a retreat called Finding Our Way, and it's a retreat for homeless men and women. And so they come from St. John the Evangelist Homeless Shelter and from New Community Shelter for an overnight experience. And so, which is a tremendous experience just in and of itself, but gives them the space and the time and the place to just kind of reflect on where they're at, where they've been in their life, where they're at, and then set some goals for where they'd like to go. Then we do a follow-up day with the group about 2 to 3 weeks later, just kind of touching base with their journey a little bit. And those retreats, like I said, this will be our fifth one, and they have been tremendous. It's one of the, I think, the best thing I do all year is the Finding Our Way retreats.
That sounds spectacular, and I'm sure there's inspiring stories to be told.
There's been incredible growth by some people. People who have, you know, truly come from the streets, living in shelters, who have now gotten jobs and living in their own apartments and doing great things. So not to say everybody's like that, and we don't have all success stories, of course, but there are those stories, and it's an incredible opportunity, and it's a blessing to be able to walk the journey with some of the men and women.
Well, certainly going out to the margins.
So that's kind of that pushing the boundaries out to what we offer at the center, I think, is important.
Well, how about you personally in terms of what sustains you spiritually? You know, maybe some of these programs, but I just think back to my life and the changes that have occurred. You know, I was born prior to Vatican II. I learned my Latin prayers. I was an altar boy. In fact, I was a finalist for the altar boy.
Didn't know they had these competitions.
No, there was a competition. It was some kind of magazine. We got to find this.
Is this like the fastest bagger at the grocery store or what?
I could wash the hands. It's faster than anyone. But
hold that patent under someone's chin just perfectly straight.
I did all that stuff. Yes. And so then Vatican II comes along. I remember... So I would have been 13 at the end of Vatican II, and there was excitement in the air. We were in a parish. I mean, I grew up in Brilliant. The pastor there was really into Vatican II. He was giving weekly or monthly presentations on the documents. Excitement, being in a seminary, excitement, a lot of, you know. And boy, it seemed like this, we were on the move. And then... the excitement wore off for various reasons, and probably I would say as we hit the early 1980s, things changed in some drastic ways. And again, I think expressed today in diminished resources for parishes and for the church, in attendance going down, less and less youth interested in necessarily working in the church. And so, you know, in certain moments, I get pretty pessimistic about the future of the church. I look at we have three daughters. Their engagement with the church is minimal at best, if any. And I certainly understand that. You may be aware, you've probably heard me say this, but in recent surveys, for the first time since any kind of surveys have been done, women are leaving the Catholic Church at a greater number than men. Which is not a good sign by any stretch. So you look around and say, wow, are we on a sinking ship? And how do I sustain hope? So I'm looking for some advice here.
Well, I'll tell you, my hope, you know, I look at two guys who bookend my ministry right now. And on the front side of it was Father Orv Jansen, who was your former pastor at St. Bernard's.
You bet.
Down in Appleton as well. He was such a man of service. That guy... The guy was taking in people from the margins and having them stay at his home, his rectory, and helping people. He had this thing called the emergency fund, which was basically just a checkbook that he got donations, and then he was able to help people with assistance and rent and this and that. And that guy was an incredible witness to me.
He was incredible. Scripture
scholar, master homilist.
Yes.
But I think... And I think I appreciate him more and more every passing day since his death. Maybe didn't as much when he was living. I mean, I appreciated him, but probably more so now. But, the guy was like a saint in terms of what he was doing for the poor in the Appleton area. you bookend that with now Pope Francis and his, I mean, just recently, he just came out with a statement on Sunday, I think, saying that, you know, we need to not just serve a meal to the poor, we need to engage in the stories, the lives of the poor. And so as bookends, I mean, I've really taken that as a personal challenge. So back in 94, I know I've told you this story, but went on my first it's called Young Neighbors in Action. It was a service immersion experience for young people. We went to the East Coast of Hartford, Connecticut. And that was the first time where I mean, truly had the words of Matthew 25 sink into my heart and challenge me and inspire me and kind of kick me in the butt and say, you know, let's get going on something. And so it took me about 10 years to kind of figure that all out. But in 2004, Deacon Steve Meyer and I started an organization called Streetlights Outreach. And it was a street ministry that we created. It served a need that we had in Green Bay at the time. And that was kind of an impetus for the starting of St. John the Evangelist Homeless Shelter. Oh. It was us sitting down with Father Guy Blair and talking about the need for a homeless shelter. And so that shelter evolved then in 2005 and beyond. And so since that time, Streetlights continues, and we continue to do what we call block parties down in Whitney Park. And we've started a program called Spokes of Hope, which is a bike repair program that over the past 2 years, we've fixed 350 bikes for people on the streets, homeless men and women. We started a community garden called the Giving Garden, growing hundreds of pounds of veggies for area shelters. And then our newest venture is a program called Amani Outreach, Amani being Swahili for peace. And that's a program where volunteers go into the homes of seniors and developmentally disabled adults and helping them with simple home adjustments that they can't do themselves anymore. So putting a light bulb that's too high to reach in, or installing a battery and a smoke detector, and those simple kinds of things. But in the process, building a relationship through a listening ear. And so what we decided to do is take all four of those programs. In this past year, we started a nonprofit, an umbrella called Whatsoever You Do, which comes right out of Matthew 25. So it's, you know, how, you know, it's kind of life is circling journey. You know?
Sure.
And so Whatsoever You Do is this umbrella nonprofit that kind of houses all four of those programs. And so we're we're continuing to kind of march on with seeing a need, filling a need. And I would say, to me, that's what gives me hope, is that we can take the faith. We don't just go to church on Sunday for an hour. Our faith, I think Richard Rohr says it so well, our faith is something that we live. It's a, if you want to be a disciple of Jesus, it's not a belief. It's not a, it's not just a creed. It's a way of life. And so, you know, yes, you can listen to a homily, you can attend a worship service, but unless you can translate that to some tangible building of the body of Christ out in the world, it kind of is a dead faith, I think. So that's how I get my hope and my energy, is through connection to the people on the margins. And I mean, I just truly believe. I believe in, there's two scripture stories that I feel have such power for me. And one is the Good Samaritan story. Because the Good Samaritan story is the answer. It's Jesus' answer to a really, really important question. And the question was, who is my neighbor? And Jesus says, well, I'll tell you who your neighbor is. And he tells the Good Samaritan story. And if you take that story from Luke and you bookend it with Matthew 25 by saying, okay, how are you gonna attain heaven? You're gonna attain heaven by serving your neighbor. Answer the question right and you will experience heaven. But serving the neighbor is feeding the hungry, giving drink to the thirsty, clothing the naked, etc. So that's what gives me hope, and I feel like that's where the church could really reawaken. And I think they do it through my second book and person, St. Francis, calling people through word and modeling, this is what it's like to be a disciple of Jesus.
Yeah, I have to say, and again, I know college and college teaching, sometimes we've been detached from the invite. You know, it's almost as though we're in our ivory tower here. And, but more and more I find in my teaching that it has to make a concrete difference and it has to lead to service. I teach a course on providence, suffering, freedom here. The service learning component is so critical, I think, for students even to understand the meaning of the religious language, that you have to listen to people and as they testify to their hardships, but also how faith sustains them. And I think that's really critically important. If we, time's running out on us here, but let's dream for a moment. The church of the future, 20 years from now, what would you see as the church of the future? Because I dreamt a dream back in 70 of what the church would be today, and I am absolutely wrong.
You're not there.
What's your dream?
Well, I think the key word is inclusion. So the church of the future, if it's not Catholic with a small c, with, I mean, being totally universal and including all, then it's really not the church. And inclusion, not just in terms of membership, but inclusion in terms of leadership, inclusion in terms of who's welcome in the community. It seems, I think it was Father Jim Martin recently in his latest book, Building Bridges, he said, you know, the church should be about you are welcome, come on in and be healed, versus get healed and then come on in.
Yes.
And I think that's that, if the church would really take that seriously, and when I say church, I mean like all of us, leadership and all of us. If we take that seriously, that has, I think, tremendous power. But right now we're kind of living in a, still in a framework of get yourself right and then come on in, you'll be welcomed. That's not what Jesus was about. So the church of the future will take seriously what Jesus was all about, and we'll understand that faith is not a noun of something we believe in, some creed, some words on a page. Faith is a verb, and it's something we live, and we do it by including our brothers and sisters, especially those most on the margin.
I cannot agree with you more. I think if the church is Catholic and wants to make universal claims, then it has to be universal, which means it has to be inclusive and must be open to a wide range, and that we are, and I love the image that Pope Francis uses of a field hospital. We don't go to church on Sunday because we're great or good or whatever. We go because we need help and we need the grace of God that we experience through the word proclaimed, through the sacrament, and through each other. And that is, for me too, the church of the future. And I'm afraid we are running out of time.
Already? This was so short.
This was really fun.
We can talk for the next week.
Yeah, I was going to say, if anyone is still listening. but this was fun, and thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for all you do.
Good, thanks. With 1 minute to go.
Oh. Because we didn't use that last minute, Howard.
Well, I didn't want to run off.
I'm kidding.
Okay, you'll be able to resume this interview. No, I think we're done.
We're done.
Lauren!
How
do I have...
She went to sleep.
I had 6 minutes remaining.
Oh, that's okay, Howard.
Oh,
shoot. We ended up fine, I think. Don't you?
Yeah, no, I think so. Yeah, but I know, I would have kept going, but I thought we had 40.
Yeah.
Something's... Wait, no. Is it recording? Elapsed. Okay. Done.
You
can laugh. Hello?
That'll be the outtake. Oh, jeez. Oh, my God.
You will not be able to resume. Yes.